accession number 19860, reel 3.
And Zips, reel 3. He had the initiative to throw the first grenade before the Chinese realised what was happening and gave himself a chance to escape. But he had, of course, he was under some pressure, so he was hyped up, he couldn't remember what happened to Brown. But Brown eventually came in. Brown had got stuck on the wire coming back, and he eventually lingered in, much to our relief, because we thought we'd lost Brown. Well, Shannon got a mention in dispatches for this. But what amused me, as always with these situations, was that everybody volunteered.
What was your own morale like in Korea?
What do you mean? You're talking about morale of my people and me?
Yes.
Oh, no problem at all. Don't forget, you've got an awful lot of camaraderie in situations where you're in danger. There's always some comedian making a funny crack.
Did the political aspect of the war mean anything to you at all?
Not at all, no. It was very complex anyway. Very complex. I'm not even sure, having read about it since, that Syngman Rhee was the most ideal of presidents anyway. It was a much peculiar business. But we certainly weren't... All we were doing was fighting for king and country, if you like. And we did as we were told. We weren't too concerned. As, of course, particular regular soldiers are never too politically concerned, you know. I remember some officers saying they never voted, for example. It's quite common to find that a professional officer doesn't feel he has any right to vote. I don't agree with that personally, but I've heard people say that. And certainly political situation in the lower ranks was, we weren't concerned. You know, we understood the communists were there and they had to be stopped. That's all.
Why should they feel that they didn't have the right to vote?
Well, of course, this is their own conscience. I imagine they felt that since they were servants of the crown, they owed their allegiance to the crown. And the political people, they would do as they were bid. It didn't matter who they voted for, they would still do as they were told, because that was their role. I imagine that would be the fact. Don't forget, every regular soldier signed an oath of allegiance to the crown, not to the government, of course. You always do what the government wants you to.
So, when you left Korea, you'd been there a year?
Yes.
Had you been wounded or fallen sick in any way?
No way, no problem at all. I don't know. You must realize, again, the conditions were not pleasant. You can imagine living in a situation, literally in a hole in the ground, when you were in the trenches. When you came out, you were living in tented accommodation. Some of it was not as good as others. Generally, when we first got out there, we were living in bivouac tents. That's two-man tents. And in snow conditions, they were not very pleasant. But things did improve, and we had larger tents later on, and some form of heating. But the conditions were anything but pleasant from the point of view of day-to-day living. There was plenty of food, of course, and plenty of warm clothing. But and particularly the with the DLI, we were very well supported by the families in Durham, the association in Durham. I think we had a radio set, for example, an international. A radio set which would command world service. About one in every five people had a radio set given them by the people of Durham. They were continually sending us packages of goodies, you know, sweets and chocolates and tobacco and cigarettes. We were very well supported by the people back home.
So in what mood did you come to leave Korea?
Well, we were going to another station. We were told it was a pleasant one. We were going to the Middle East.
And was it?
Well, yes, very pleasant, I found.
Was this Egypt?
Egypt. Hmm.
The canal zone?
Canal zone, Fanara. A place called Fanara. And, of course, this was largely, although we were under some minor guerrilla activity, we would get the Egyptians would rob us if they could. You know, they would come in and steal things from us. Well, there were no real physical violence there, in my experience anyway. And so it was largely a peacetime station, and something that I'd hardly experienced, frankly. And, you know, for most of the time I'd be on active service, really. And this was very pleasant. You know, this was getting up early in the morning, because it was particularly in the summer, and we'd all be finished by midday. You'd start rally at 5, and then you'd work until midday, have lunch, and that was the day finished. Apart from guards and the various fatigue duties that one was allocated to do, and so on. I played a lot of rugby. I'm a rugby player, actually. I played a lot of rugby over in there. And I also joined the local sailing club, which was available for troops, and did a lot of sailing in the middle Bitter Lakes. You can imagine it was quite a pleasant affair compared with what we'd been doing before. Again, we were living in tents, but of course the weather was very decent. It wasn't bad weather. Could be cold, but never that cold. It could be windy, of course, with a lot of sand about. And, of course, we had a sergeant's mess, and we were invited to various sergeant's mess parties with other regiments and so on. It could be very pleasant. I found it excellent.
Were you ever attacked by the Egyptians?
No.
So what did the work involve?
Well, you've got to keep the camp rolling. You've got to guard various ammunition dumps and that type of thing. We had huge dumps of ammunition, and the various people were given roles in looking after these, guarding them from them. Otherwise, the Egyptians would pinch them. I think it was largely a question of thieves rather than guerrilla activity.
What losses to theft did you have?
Well, I remember them breaking in and pinching the colonel's uniform, all his gear, that type of thing, you see. Of all people to steal from was the Colonel May.
How did he take that?
Well, I remember we were on the range next day, and he had to come out in civvies. He hadn't any uniform. This is how we knew about him.
And you appear to have been in the canal zone from 53 to 55.
Yes.
Mm. How did you come to leave the army?
The reason I left the army was because I met my wife. And I didn't think, although it's a very good life for single men who like sport and like activities and so on, it isn't the life for a family man, in my opinion. And certainly not my wife. My wife would never have taken to a sergeant's mess. No way.
Why not?
Well, I mean, a sergeant's mess is a very nice place for single men, but I don't think it's the best place for a... It isn't a place for... You get rough and tough sergeants. It isn't a place for women, I don't think.
Because of swearing and so on?
Well, no, not that. The general attitude is masculine rather than feminine. Oh, no, generally speaking, you don't get swearing in a sergeant's mess. It's, oh, dear me, no. I mean, you might get the odd so-and-so, but it really isn't. Swearing in the army is not, certainly in messes, is not looked on. Is looked on with great disfavour, in my opinion. In the mess, you might get a bit of hard language outside, but nothing inside the mess. Anyway, what happened was I bought myself out. We came back to England, Barnard Castle, and I'd met my wife, and I decided that I wanted to think of a more stable existence than the regular army. And so I came out and married her, and we lived happily ever after.
What's the difference between a machine gun and a submachine gun?
Well, a machine gun is one that is meant to be put on the ground with two supports, that type of thing, or three supports, depending on the design. A submachine gun is something you hold in your hand. Tommy gun, if you like. Does that help you? Tommy gun is a submachine gun. When I got back to England, One of our officers was a chap called de la Billier. He subsequently became Sir Peter de la Billier, but in those days he was second lieutenant or lieutenant de la Billier. And he wanted a motor car, and in order to help him get it, he wanted to sell his motorbike. So I bought the motorbike, and he got his motor car. I paid him for it. It was a good motorbike, no problem. When I left the army, I bought the motorbike with me, and eventually sold the motorbike and bought an engagement ring. Years later, sitting where you're sitting now, I came in one night from work, and my wife was watching the television, and Sir Peter de la Billier, who I'd never heard of since, appeared as the commander of the Gulf War. And I said, "Dear, that's the man who provided your engagement ring," in an indirect way. That's the end of the story, really.